The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Frisch, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Michelle Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 12th day of October 2023. We're here for oral arguments in three cases. As you may have noticed, our third colleague, Judge Hallbrooks, is joining us via Zoom. She is in Minnesota, but is unexpectedly, definitely unable to be here. So we appreciate her participating in this format, and I'll keep an eye on you for questions. The first case is Narad versus Magnus. Would each of the attorneys be sure to introduce his or herself before beginning each leg of your argument? And could you tell me the agreement which has been reached in terms of sharing of time by the respondents? My colleague has told me, and I've already forgotten.
Your Honor, it's 10 minutes and 5 minutes.
10 and 5. Thank you very much. With that, we are ready to hear from counsel for appellant.
Thank you.
If anyone needs to adjust the height of the microphone, please feel free to take the time to do so.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Boyning, and I represent Patrice Narad, the appellant in this matter. I'd like to start my presentation here with a little bit of background for the court. The respondents, defendants, represented Patrice Narad from 2009 to 2017. And Ms. Narad's complaint recognizes the common denominator throughout the times, the representation was provided by the defendants or respondents, that the common denominator there was is that defendant Magnus was unfortunately addicted to methamphetamines. Both respondents in this case argue that all of Ms. Nerd's claims are time barred and that she's failed to establish causation in this matter. It's our position that that all the claims were properly pled and withstand in Rule 12 motion to dismiss. I think at the outset it's important to differentiate between the allegations or claims against defendant Magnus and those against Jones and Magnus law offices. The claims against each party are separate and distinct claims that give rise to cause of action where accrual for statute of limitations analysis accrue independently within the set of facts and therefore trigger separate accrual dates. And that's going to be somewhat of my focus. I'm going to be staying within the context of the complaint because I think any argument that is presented was properly addressed in the allegations.
Counsel, it's my understanding that you're not necessarily questioning that some damage had occurred outside of the limitations period that your client would have known. But that it was fraudulently concealed?
Correct.
What was concealed that prevented your client from understanding her damage? When there are adverse rulings that she is aware of all along the way outside of the limitations period.
I think that we have to get into the tolling mechanisms under fraudulent concealment for a couple of those. For me to be able to answer that question.
But her damage wasn't concealed from her. When there's an adverse ruling and she's notified of her adverse ruling, it's not concealed.
Well, the material fact that he was operating or practicing under the influence was concealed.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, there are a lot of people, a lot of attorneys, unfortunately, that suffer from addiction issues or mental health issues, but the fact that they may be addicted to an illegal drug or addicted to alcohol or laboring under a mental health concern doesn't necessarily mean that they have operated below a reasonable, a standard of practice. Where's that allegation in the complaint that his addiction rendered him necessarily as an attorney that acted below a standard of practice?
Well, I think the actual allegations are contained within the counts of the complaint, and I would agree to the extent with your comments about about typically whether it's because there's an addiction problem, an alcohol problem, or something like that. I could understand a much more of an argument that's something for the board, or that's something that needs to be cleared up within certain confines. The problem that we have in this case is the pure longevity, the consistency of the addiction, which we believe goes all the way back through the entire representation period, and comparing it as it has been compared to, it might be a lazy attorney, it might be an attorney that just wasn't paying attention or something like that. I think that's apples and oranges. I think the real issue here is the severity of the abuse, the longevity of the abuse, the continuance of the abuse, despite all of the efforts that were made from many people to get clean. I think it takes it outside of the realm of just somebody that needs some help, and it puts it in the realm of where it was so detrimental to my client's 16-year struggle to get her rulings overturned that it falls within the framework of a fraudulent concealment.
So your argument is that the addiction itself is the malpractice?
I'm arguing that it's a factor of the malpractice. I think the malpractice, I don't think you can get to the malpractice without addressing the addiction. I think that the addiction has to be considered as a causal factor for the malpractice. And you know, we've pled this as under a continuing breach of fiduciary duty theory, along with the malpractice claim. But I would say that yes, the malpractice in this instant was a part and parcel of the addiction was a part and parcel of the legal malpractice.
What did the complaint allege regarding the firm's knowledge of the addiction?
I believe the complaint itself alleged that they were aware of the addiction and did not take proper remedial measures. And some of this is within different, obvious, different complaint causes of action, but the general complaint where it was where and I'm sorry, I lost my question. Could you repeat it for me?
But your theory is it was fraudulently concealed by the law firm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Other than the addiction, is there any other material fact that you're claiming was fraudulently concealed that would have prevented your client from understanding that she had a legal malpractice claim?
No.
I have a question, if I could interrupt. Sure. Mr. Binning, to get back to the point, can I be heard?
Yeah, you can.
Okay. Get back to the point that Judge Frisch raised initially with respect to the prior Court of Appeals decisions. I just want to ask you, focusing specifically on the NARED versus Regions Hospital matter, it was, I'm sure, well argued by Mr. White, very accomplished appellate counsel. But ultimately, as I understand this court's decision, it affirmed the dismissal on statute of limitations ground, and it also said that that really the allegations were a collateral attack on the civil commitment as opposed to a traditional Med-Mal case. So how does that impact the strength of your argument here?
I think that, honestly, that's probably the weakest part of my argument would be the Regions claim. I think that has to be brought up. If it is a malpractice component, that would have to be brought up through a tolling mechanism based on the fraud or the fraudulent concealment. I'm not sure I can answer that any better than that, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Can I ask you about the real estate transaction?
Yes.
It's my understanding that counsel was discharged before the limitations period expired. Is that
correct? Correct.
And so there was a new law firm that was retained?
Correct.
And the new law firm was at the helm when the limitations period expired.
Correct.
Why isn't that firm on the hook for malpractice?
They could be, but that, at this stage, I'm not the malpractice. Our malpractice for that particular issue has to do with the representation, the length of the representation that was provided by Mr. Magnus, which was all the way up. To 2 months before an arbitration clause needed to be executed or arbitration needed to be put into play.
I mean, I'm having some challenges with the proximate cause issue in that space. So help me out here. Is there any authority that would stand for the proposition that in Minnesota that stands for the proposition that a law firm that has had a case for a while or a lawyer that's had a case for some period of time but doesn't take any action and is discharged before the limitations period expires can still be on the hook for malpractice for failing to file the action within the limitations period?
Not directly on point with that, Your Honor.
What's the best authority that would help you there?
The best authority was actually that I was able to find was in the Friesen case, which was, as counsel had mentioned earlier, was overturned on a summary judgment ground. I think that the issue of the damages are still in play that would survive a summary motion, a Rule 12 motion. That seems to me to be an issue that would be more aptly decided under a summary judgment standard, as is with all of the causation issues that are being argued in this case. Excuse me. So, I think I'd like to go into a little bit more into the fraudulent concealment, if that works with the court. The argument is for the fraudulent concealment is that the claim did not identify, or the count did not identify a particular claim that was concealed. It's our position that the complaint was alleged properly. It was alleged properly both as an independent standalone claim and a tolling claim. The elements for the independent claim are absolutely met with the duty to disclose, knowledge of material fact, intent to deceive, justifiable reliance, and damages. Those are the elements. The fact that there was not a claim identified that was concealed does not take away from the fraudulent concealment of the material fact of the drug usage. The concealment itself, and if one were to look at the actual pleadings, each one of the claims that have been put forth in the complaint specifically addresses the use of drugs and alcohol as one of the elements in each one of those complaints or in each one of those claims or causes of action. I think that that's enough with the incorporating by reference, and when you're looking at the complaint as a whole, that carries that. If there needs to be a claim that was fraudulently concealed, that would satisfy that burden.
Can you connect for me the assertion that the firm fraudulently concealed the chemical addiction with your client's damages? How was your client damaged, and how do we know it was caused by the firm's concealment?
I think that we know that the client has been damaged. I think that the client has been damaged by the fraudulent concealment. based on her, you know, her lack of community, you know, whether it's reputation damages, whether there are actual damages involved. But I also think that we're talking about issues that are more akin to a summary judgment motion and factual issues, and I think that that would be something that I would have the ability to more fully address were this a motion that isn't a motion on the pleadings. And I've been pretty consistent with that, and it's been a little bit of a challenge, and I've tried to stay away from arguing summary judgment issues. And so my memorandum the dismissals and briefing, I've purposely stayed away from being somewhat egged into making summary judgment arguments. This is a motion on the pleadings. Causation is a fact issue. I believe that that for purposes of a 1202E hearing, that I should have the, under a de novo review especially, I should have the right on behalf of my client to more fully expand on those throughout the course of the litigation. But for purposes of the 1202E, it's properly pled.
All right. Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Who is arguing first?
May it please the court, Eric Steinhoff on behalf of respondent Ryan Magnus. Thank you. This case results from legal representation in these three underlying matters that the court is aware of that's been addressed. The first two were properly dismissed based on the face of the complaint and the statute of limitations. All of the counts in the complaint relate to these underlying representations, and all of the statute of limitations would apply to all of them. The third count, which we'll get to in a minute, relates to the real estate transaction and was dismissed under the face of the complaint and the allegations in the complaint based on causation and in Minnesota law establishing that. With regard to the statute of limitations, the first two, the medical malpractice claim and the civil commitment order, Ms. Nierad was damaged well prior to the commencement, and the statute of limitations period expired well prior to the commencement of this action.
I don't think she's claiming that the damage was fraudulently concealed. She knew she was damaged. She's claiming that the reason she was damaged was fraudulently concealed. She didn't know that there was some action by your client that caused the damage to occur.
Right. I do believe that fraudulent concealment is the real issue here. I think there was some arguments in the memo about, you know, whether the sum damage rule is the proper standard. I think it is. I think it's been long held in Minnesota. But to get to the fraudulent concealment, which is where the rubber hits the road on this thing, fraudulent concealment is an equitable doctrine that only applies in certain circumstances. It applies when a claimant is ignorant of their cause of action. They don't know it exists. And if they don't know it exists, generally there's no protections for that. But there is if the defendant fraudulently concealed that it exists. And the cases use the language, the defendant fraudulently concealed from the plaintiff facts constituting the cause of action. And that's the significance here. That's where this case really, really comes down to. And that's the Minnesota Labor's Health and Welfare Fund. But it's in a lot of cases. Magnus, drug use, we can condemn that. There's criminal actions that have been taken and licensing issues. But in this case, drug use is not an element of these legal malpractice claims. It's not a fact constituting the claims.
But if the drug use caused the attorney not to properly represent the client and that was concealed from the client, why isn't that in the fraudulent concealment space?
Right. And Your Honor, the Wild versus Rarig case talks about this, not drug use, clearly, but talks about that a party does not need to know the details of evidence by which to establish his cause of action. That's evidence that could become forth, no different than My lawyer was going through a divorce. My lawyer was at the Britney Spears concert the night before trial and stayed up too late. My lawyer's too busy working on something else. My lawyer had an alcohol problem.
I don't disagree with you that the precise reason why may not be the thing, but it's what that precise thing causes the lawyer to do or not do.
Right.
And so one is related to the other.
And so the reason, the motive or the reason has to go through the actual damages and the knowledge of the damage. You have to know you have a cause of action. You don't have to know every piece of evidence you may submit to support why you have a cause of action. You need to know that you have a cause of action. And when her medical malpractice case was dismissed, she knew she was damaged, and that's when it accrues. Because if you don't apply this rule, we're really getting away from the actual damages rule we have in Minnesota. We're getting to the discovery rule because you could always come up with a reason or a piece of evidence that supports your claim. And whether the piece of evidence is drug use or something surely less severe as my client went on vacation or my lawyer went on vacation the week before trial. Both of those really, while they're different size pieces of evidence, they're both pieces of evidence that just support your cause of action. And that's why the law says very clearly you need to know about the facts constituting your cause of action.
Mr. Steinhoff, may I interrupt you for a moment? I want to look specifically at the claim where to vacate the civil commitment order. It's my understanding from the record that Ms. Neary had four different attorneys at various points trying to achieve that. But Mr. Magnus, I think, was retained in 2011. She had a lawyer in 2007 who intended to bring a motion to vacate, apparently never did. I don't know why. And then Mr. Magnus, it seemed, wanted to pursue a motion to vacate and seal the record. It took him an additional 3 years to actually bring that motion. So by this point, it was 7 years post-civil commitment order. Can one infer from the failure to bring that in a more timely basis, I'm talking about Mr. Magnus, that that is evidence of his addiction and then concealment of that addiction?
Yeah, thank you. I think I heard you. I don't get to see you anymore. The computer kind of went a little haywire, but I think I got the question. I guess the first answer would be, I don't think that matters for the purposes of this. The fact of it, that I'm arguing is she saw in the order dismissing the Rule 12 motion or denying the Rule 12 motion that it was untimely. She was aware that she'd been damaged in the allegations. Whether that can infer the reasons behind things, I don't know that you can ever infer the reasons behind various things that are being done, and I don't know that that's evidence of drug use in this instance, to answer your question. But I think the more important perspective is it doesn't really matter the motivation. What matters for statute of limitations purposes is, was the appellant on notice of a potential claim to trigger the accrual? And really what we're doing when we fall back on this is, if she had brought a complaint the next day, would have it been dismissed on Rule 12? And the answer is it wouldn't have. There was enough there that my lawyer did it. It was untimely. I have a claim. And that's what accrual really means. That's the starting point. Would it survive?
Okay, so what you're saying is the key here is it was dismissed because it was untimely. It wasn't dismissed on the merits. It was dismissed on a procedural basis that was clearly attributable to the attorney, and we don't need to know why he failed to timely file, but we know he did fail to comply with the timing rules, and that would indicate performance below an objective standard and perhaps malpractice.
Right, and that's when the claim accrued, so we have to start the clock. And statute of limitations is an unforgiving thing. We all know that. When it applies, it applies. A case could have been brought. She was damaged. It wouldn't have been dismissed. So a fraudulent concealment and this drug use, which is not an element, again, was not required for her to bring the case. She had the stuff to bring the case. It's just evidence she may have used, doesn't restart the statute of limitations. Because if it did, there would be any number of allegations that lawyers could come up with that would always restart it. Because would it really be much different? My client, my lawyer is an alcoholic, my lawyer, and you can keep going down from that until you get to silly examples, I understand. But where do you draw the line? You draw the line based on the established law of, Did you have a cause of action, and were you aware of the facts constituting the cause of action? And that's what we have here. Your Honors, briefly, to move to the real estate matter, which is a little different, the big argument, and I don't think we have to go through all of this again, obviously the agreed upon facts, the facts alleged in the complaint, paragraph 34, I believe, is that she had a new lawyer 2 months before this demand for arbitration. And a demand for arbitration is literally that. I demand arbitration. It's not a whole trial. It's not anything beyond that. But the reason that this fails causation is we have two cases on this. We have the Friesen case, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court case, and your court's case is an unpublished case that addressed this. And this makes sense. This is not only the law, but it makes sense. Mr. Magnus had no duty to demand an arbitration 2 months after he wasn't her lawyer, but more importantly, had no right to. So you're putting a lawyer in a situation where he cannot resolve this once he's fired. There's no malpractice in waiting 2 months before demanding an arbitration and waiting within that period to see what happens with the case. So the malpractice that's alleged here, by definition, would have occurred after he wasn't her lawyer. And lawyers can't be put in that situation because there's nothing he could do about it. He had no remedy to even fix this, even if he knew of the deadline. The argument that's been put forth relates to summary judgment versus Rule 12. Those other cases were on summary judgment. The important part of this is the law. The law was correctly applied. Well, there are different standards and where you get the facts. Summary judgment, you get them from everything, and Rule 12, you get them from the complaint. The fact of the matter is, the facts were in the complaint. The district court judge correctly took the facts as alleged. We didn't argue beyond the complaint, appellant's counsel didn't. And as a result, the court correctly applied the law and correctly dismissed all of the counts in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. It's like we're having minor technical difficulties. Judge Halbrechts, we can hear you loud and clear, but we can no longer see you.
Stream.
Judge Larkin, I don't want to delay the continuing arguments just because my face isn't there.
It has been fixed.
Everyone see.
Okay.
Thanks to the marshal. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I didn't want to interrupt counsel's argument or your exchange for that purpose because we could all hear you very clearly. Now we can see you as well. And who is appearing for the law firm?
Yes, Your Honor. Shannon Ekman on behalf of Jones Law.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Shannon Ekman, and I represent Jones Law. First, I would like to address some loose ends from Respondent Magnus's argument and also appellant's argument. First, I would like to bring to the court's attention regarding the continuous and severity longevity of the drug use. Minnesota has explicitly rejected a continuous representation doctrine as it pertains to legal negligence. And this some damage rule has been explicitly adopted by Minnesota to curb open-ended liability for attorneys, as Magnus touched on, for claims coming well after statute of limitation issues. Next, I would also like to add to some authority on the real estate matter, which comes from Togstedt and the Scholes case, which states and supports that an attorney who was formerly on a file cannot be held liable for missing the statute of limitations when there was still time left for new counsel to comply with the statute of limitations. And then next, I would like to also bring to the court's attention the final count of vicarious liability for Jones Law. As we've argued today, respondents have argued today, vicarious liability only pertains to claims in torts. And where underlying tort claims fail, so too does vicarious liability. And today, all the underlying tort claims contained within the complaint fail, either for being time barred or as a matter of law. And so this court should affirm the district court's dismissal of that claim as well. And finally, as for the summary judgment standard argument that appellant has set forth, It's important to note that the complaint is not just the four corners of the complaint itself, but also all the documents in which the court or in which the complaint embraced, including all the exhibits from Ms. Narad and also two Court of Appeals decisions and district court order in which the district court relied upon in making its Rule 12 decision. And the determination that these claims fell short was well supported by the complaint in its totality. And likewise, this court should affirm the district court's dismissal of the complaint in its entirety and with prejudice. Unless there are any questions, I will just thank you for my time.
I do not see any questions. Thank you for your argument. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Briefly, Your Honors. I wanted to touch base on the issue of whether or not a finding of fraudulent concealment would actually subsume the other allegations, and I think that it indirectly goes to the points that were just made. If, in fact, there was fraudulent concealment, whether that's under a standalone or under a tolling mechanism, the breach of contract claims, the breach of fiduciary duty claim, the breach of implied covenant would fall with under that rubric. A claim can subsume other claims when fraudulent conduct alleged in the claim encompasses or includes the elements of the other causes of action. That's how it's been pled. I wanted to make that point. On the motion to vacate, one of the issues that we've had a problem with is that as far as under a statutory agreeing or at least recognizing the argument, the panel or the judge in the 2023 decision that actually finally vacated the notice of motion or the motion to vacate did address the fact that there was ineffective assistance of counsel earlier on in the case. I don't believe that's by any extent dispositive of the issue of when the statute of limitations was applied. There was, in fact, an opening within the order itself, which is why it was relitigated, that said that Ms. Narad could follow up with the court and present her argument, which is what she did. We were within the time frames for a statute of limitations argument. That's because the time when that case would have survived a motion to dismiss, we're running past that 2014 deadline. I'm not sure that I can, in all forthrightness, say when that was, but I think that that's a fact question. I think the actual time frame for that would be something somewhere between 2014 and 2017 or 2022, and I think that that's something that would be more appropriately addressed under summary judgment motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all the attorneys for your arguments and for your briefing. The matter has been submitted. You'll have our decision within